You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 325, how Terence has dealt manfully with the flu. Rucksack ructions with Darren Brown. And yet more incompetence at the Football Association. And the BBC employs theatre critics who don't like going to the theatre. It's all coming up after Super Furry Animals, and it's not the end of the world. Apparently.
We keep thinking that the two-paid tangerine and you know haircut man are going to finish us all off, and every week we keep coming back for another one. So in celebration of that, and also because, you know, who doesn't? If you know of the Super Furry Animals, then surely you love them. They're one of those bands who I think it's impossible to resist if you know of their oeuvre. I first come across it on their best of, which is called Songbook, and I'm not usually a best of fan, but it's really good. I think it's a great introduction to them and the great stuff they do. So that is the Super Furries, as they're colloquially known, and it's not the end of the world.
I agree with you. Gruff Rhys can do no wrong in my eyes. If you like them, you love them.
Mr. Leon Neon as well?
Oh, absolutely. That was recorded at Todd Rundgren's old studio in Bearsville, near Woodstock.
That's why you're so keen this falls into place now.
American place names, they can be so cool, can't they? Bearsville. I love looking at maps, a map of America, and noting the names like, you know, Tallahassee and Oconomowoc. Every square of the map has magic names.
I went to a, speaking of American names and British names, well, Juxtaposed, which is also the name of another super furry animal track, Juxtaposed with you. How's that for a segue? I was at the Hastings Pride event, which I think we spoke about a few weeks ago, and there's a local artiste who performs, and she was singing 24 hours from Tulsa, except she did it as 24 hours from Hastings. And I was chatting to the leader of Hastings Borough Council outside, and we were trying to work out if you drove for 24 hours from Hastings, you basically have to, it's Shetlands or bust as far as that metaphor is concerned. I don't think you can drive 24 hours from Hastings and still be on the mainland.
I think you're right. Welcome to the podcast from the Parish Council. It's episode 325. I'm Terence Stackham. And well, she's not from Bearsville, New York, Oshkosh, Wisconsin, or Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
I wish I was, though, to be fair. Oshkosh, how cool is that?
I know. Yeah, she is, as we've just heard, really, from Hastings, East Sussex. It's Juliet Harris.
It's proud to be a Haslian. That is that the local theatre company used to be called the Haslians, actually. I'm not sure if they're still trading or not, but yes, proud Haslian. Hello, good evening, and welcome, or good morning, or good afternoon.
Now, you'll know, Jules, that I'm not one to moan.
No, yeah. that is completely not in your repertoire at all.
I like to be positive, see the best in the world.
Yeah, so, you are a very cool ray of sunshine.
Absolutely, everybody knows this. So when I contracted flu immediately after recording last week's podcast...
Well, can I just point out, it was not caused by the podcast. I don't feel it was that much of an exertion, I must admit.
Well, I've been blaming you all week.
But then that's not unusual. Again, that's not unusual, is it?
I dealt with this flu as an adult. Certainly didn't moan and groan at the people around me. You can be sure of that.
No, absolutely, yeah, I am reassured.
But the most peculiar thing was losing my voice completely. This has never happened to me before in my life. I lost my voice completely for a couple of days earlier this week, and it led me to using the most modern of solutions. For those 2 days, I communicated entirely by using the notepad facility on my iPhone. So every time someone asked me a question, I made a kind of like hold on a second gesture, and then laboriously typed out my reply on the iPhone. And of course, it made me think, in the old days, I would have used a piece of paper and a pen, and it struck me that with my slow skills of tapping away with one finger, not like you youngsters with your thumbs going mad.
Well, I turn the phone onto one side, and then you can use a set of fingers. That's a top tip.
I didn't even realise you could do that.
Had you consulted me at the start of your illness rather than the end of your illness, I could have helped you tiptoe your way through the snotty tulips with much more elan.
I could have saved a lot of time and frustration. So two days masquerading as Harpo Marx for me this week, but you've been spending your time far more energetically.
Oh, yes. You see, I am a great proponent of me and my friends colloquially refer to as a BLP, which stands for Bad Life Planning. So I did have some bad life planning. As regular listeners know, last week I went to Oxford and had a lovely time, very much enjoyed that. I returned to work on Monday. Obviously, to be fair, I had some very nice locum cover in my absence, but I had a lot to do, obviously, lots to catch up on. The person that covered me was very good at dealing with some emails and not others and leading them all in my inbox. So I had to do a lot of deleting and green ticking and all kinds of odd things. I realised the day before that I had agreed to do a charity walk for my workplace. Hastings Legal Charity, so Citizens Advice, Brighton Housing Trust.
Yeah.
People like that, stuff that I'm very local legal charities, very much into that. So we just did the 6 miles after work on Monday night. Station along the seafront, which is the most beautiful route. I can highly recommend it. All the way along the beach, along the seafront, past the end of my road, rather chokingly. One wave to my road, and then we ended up in the first in, last out, or the Philo pub in Hastings. That was extremely enjoyable. Enjoyed speaking to my colleagues on the way along. Turned up at the pub. I accidentally ate part of someone's tapas-based dinners, thinking it was a buffet, and it wasn't. It was their dinner, apparently. So also had a wonderful time being... Oh, there was... There's nothing like legal people for throwing shade at each other. Well, so we did a route that our colleague David had organised. Hmm. So we did this kind of walk where, I felt it was long enough, frankly, at 6 miles. It was largely flat along the seafront, but it was quite long and, a bit windy. So started to rain at the beginning. So we did all that. And we were one of the first teams back, and we couldn't really understand why, because we had several dogs with us that were not always as well behaved as well. They were well behaved, but they were a bit circuitous, shall we say, in their routes. So what was getting there? And then gradually other teams started to come in, and we were all wearing the T-shirts of our organisation. So my white and green lot were one of the first back. And then we saw some Citizens Advice Bureau people come back. And then a lot came back from another solicitors. And they said, oh, well, we followed the route from 2 years ago with the hills, and it was much harder. No longer. Oh. No. But, I just walked 6 miles, accidentally could only drink a light ale because I had to go back to Bexhill for my car. Someone's dog weed on the floor next to where I was standing. Then I was told I was a lightweight because I hadn't done the proper thing. So, thanks, guys. So it was done in very much a charitable spirit one would expect of lawyers, which is not at all, frankly. So that was, that was the first part of my week. I also did... I went and saw some arty things last night, Terence. It didn't go very well.
Oh, dear.
We hadn't been invited. We went in. It was best summed up by my friend on Twitter later on when I complained about it. He said, A, they were all freeloaders. B, that was an art. So that kind of summed up. They weren't all freeloaders, but I found myself turning into my dad when I looked at this large ceramic cast on the floor with lots of holes in it. I wouldn't put my brushes in that. I felt a little bit like that. And also had an accidental Jesus moment. I don't know if anyone else of our listeners has had an accidental Jesus moment. It was, my friend often refers to my life as Jules Your Enthusiasm. And I had another Jules Your Enthusiasm moment where I enthusiastically greeted a friend of mine who I hadn't seen for ages. And I sort of nudged her and went, oh, hello, I nudged her. She was holding a paper cup full of red wine.
Oh, no.
Which it didn't spill, but it dripped because she'd slightly tilted her hand where I kind of taken her by surprise.
Yeah.
It was meant to be friendly. And it dripped out onto a small child that was lying on the floor beneath us under the legs of her mother, who in all fairness thought it was hilarious. And this child, the centre of her forehead, had a red wine on it. So we couldn't work out if she looked like she'd been shot or whether I had in fact managed to sort of baptise her. And of course my friend then referred to me as Jules the Baptist for the rest of the evening. She thought it was hilarious, obviously. So I learned that I wouldn't be fully accepted by the RT world. I was very grateful to the child's mother for finding it funny, because virtually nobody did. So there weren't many pastels there, Terence. It was all very
imagine
lots of kind of, oh, who's left all this old box here? Oh, that's the art.
I agree with you. I've tried very hard to be very modern about these things when going around a gallery, and then finding myself in the same sort of situation about wondering whether that chair is actually to sit on or whether it's an exhibit, and it's always something of a dilemma in these places. And fraught with pretension.
Yes, I don't want listeners to think I'm not enlightened, because I absolutely am. I went to have my cars changed at the garage this morning, and the car tyre garage place that I use had a free bowl of fruit, which was free to its patrons who wanted to reach their 5 a day. So let it not be said that I don't live a modern lifestyle, because I do. I can't be doing with I have wine at home. I don't need to go somewhere to have a paper cup of wine to look at something. So at the time we went, I really like modern art, but we did go to the Tate Modern once, and my dad said, I don't think much of that piece of art, and it did turn out to be a wall heater, but it wasn't very easy to tell what was the wall heater and what wasn't. There was a lot of deconstructed wall heaters, I wish the people well. I can't say I don't,
The other thing from my week that I just want to mention quickly is a visit we made last Saturday to the Playhouse Theatre on London's Embankment.
London's trendy embankment,
To see the excellent Darren Brown show.
I suspect he saw you coming.
No spoilers from me, because it's essential that talk about the show. But it was great. But isn't the show, but the madness and stupidity of people that I just want to tell you about. the day before London, this was Saturday, on Friday, London had suffered the bomb at Parsons Green, mercifully no fatalities. 24 hours later, we arrived at our seats at the Playhouse, row G in the stalls, about 20 minutes before showtime, and saw a huge rucksack, a backpack in America.
On
the floor, about three or four seats away from us, with nobody sitting in those seats.
Oh, gosh.
Now, there was a bloke a few seats further beyond the rucksack, and I asked him if it was his, and he said no in that very British way of kind of, don't involve me in this, you know, no, it's nothing to do with me. So, we're now, just about 15 minutes to go to the performance. I looked around for an usher, a programme seller, anyone to alert, not a theatre person in sight. We were in the stalls, quite a small theatre. I dashed into the foyer. Massive queue for the bar, no ushers or theatre people. So just as I was, I was going to jump up on the stage because there were stairs going up to it as part of the act.
And people say, yes.
I was going to jump on the stage and just say, is there an usher in the house?
I'm glad you were going to say that rather than there's a rucksack over there, because I can't see that would have ended well.
No. And then just as I was just saying, I'm going to go on the stage, a lively...
Well, I felt that, you should always, I always feel you should be on the stage, Terence, at any given moment, treading the boards.
Exactly. It's my calling, but this would have been in highly unusual circumstances. Yes. This lively couple of young girls, possibly 17, 18, returned from the bar, sat down, picked up the rucksack and sipped at their drinks, oblivious that most of row G by this time were now hovering nervously in the aisle, looking round and, looking for leadership. So just two things. 24 hours after a terrorist incident, how daft do you have to be to leave a backpack unattended in a London theatre?
Kids, eh? Kids.
And where were all the staff? Do they actually employ, again, in the current level of threat in London, they actually employ anyone at these theatres? We saw a couple of security people at the main entrance when you came in and said, show your tickets, let's see your tickets. And then there was some bar staff. But apart from that, pretty much no one else. We found our own way to our seats. Just thank goodness it was a false alarm.
Well, absolutely. And I'm very surprised by the absence of ushers. It's not even like I can do my usual, Pat's in the public sector thing, because it isn't the public sector, is it? So, indeed. And just think, this time in a fortnight's time, you won't even be able to take an Uber there, Terence.
Indeed. Will we? Because they're appealing. I've heard they've lodged their appeal today, and I can't see... I see them winning that appeal, because I think
them winning that appeal if they're able to show that they are making changes in order to satisfy PFL's requirements.
I'm not supporting them, but I think they'll win the appeal.
And actually the most interesting thing about this story for me is the fact that the only people I see that are defending Uber are people that are saying, it's made it so much... There are people that are complaining about black cab drivers, particularly complaining that they're not always great with women or people of colour. I don't know if that's true or not, but I've seen some people, complaining about that. The only people that are complaining about Uber are complaining about the fact that the system was broken anyway before Uber came into place. I think Uber are a dreadful company anyway, frankly. And I'm also very amused by the fact that Uber are now going down the whole people will lose their jobs lines. So are you saying you're an employer now, Uber? Because your previous line was that you weren't an employer. Everyone was self-employed because they didn't have employment rights. So if Uber is willing to accept the fact that it employs people and therefore gives them consequential rights, and also puts into account safety checks... Because people saying, it's much, I feel much safer as a woman being able to get into an Uber. Yeah, but it's no different to a minicab. They won't check their drivers, is it?
You're absolutely right. And, of course, if it does go wrong for Uber, another company would just step into the breach anyway and undertake service. This is already happening in America. There's a company called Lyft, LYFT, who are, encroaching into sort of Uber spaces, and the many other smaller companies emerging.
My dad always refers to taxis as Joe Baxi, so if anybody wants to start up Joe Baxi Inc., then please do send a stamped addressed envelope to the usual address.
Perhaps no surprise that the Football Association has cornered itself into yet another bungling muddle.
Who saw that one coming,
Total incompetence. We're looking at that after Fleetwood Mac. To my love, to my love.
took it down. I climbed a mountain and I turned around, and I saw my reflection in snow-covered hills till the landslide brought me down. Oh, mirror in the sky, what is love? Can the child within my heart rise above? Can I sail through the changing ocean tides? Can I handle the seasons of my life?
In 1975, when she was 26 years old and worried that she was getting too old for this rock and roll business. Stevie Nicks with Fleetwood Mac from the album Before Rumours, which subsequently has been rather, you know, overshadowed by. But from the album Fleetwood Mac, that's a lovely track, Landslide.
Absolutely. No, I'm a very big fan of that. I think it's lovely. Also, tunes called Landslide are never a bad thing. I heard one by, I can't remember if it was the Pop Guns or the Darling Buds the other day, but if you, and also the Northern Soul classic Landslide as well. So what can I say? Many, many good picks to be had there.
Well, Jules, it's happened again. Rather regularly, we are, figuratively speaking, finding ourselves on Wembley Way, heading towards another Football Association
Much of this podcast often feels like Groundhog Day, but that is not the fault of us, I don't think. It's the fact that it's the same... You know, same stuff, different day, isn't it, in the world of news?
Yeah, but Football Association statements, they're usually full of sincere frowning, breast-beating and time for a fresh new start-ism, delivered by a grey-looking man in a grey suit at a grey Wembley. And this time it follows the sacking of the manager of the England women's football team. And the FA says that evidence emerged of inappropriate, I'm quoting, and unacceptable behaviour, end of quote, that dates back to a time before he was the England manager. But here's the thing, Jules. He was investigated over this matter that happened at Bristol and no disciplinary action followed. There have been later allegations since he took the England job. There have been two investigations into these matters and he was cleared of any wrongdoing. So... Why has the FA sacked Mark Sampson?
Well, actually, this is the moment where once again I have to praise My Guardian. Hmm. I mean, don't get me wrong, My Guardian is annoying me in many and various ways and has been for some time. But I have to say they've got a few journalists there in their football and sports kind of a section. Daniel Taylor in particular, who we'll talk about today, who take an investigative line on things and managed to break really big stories. It was them that broke the story about the sort of increasing scandal regarding abuse and coaches of young boys in there.
Yes.
And they did a lot of work on that story. Yes. and really did bring a lot of things into light. I've also been following this Ennio Luca story. So to kind of summarise for people that might not know, so the background is that Mark Samps has been England manager for a few years, England women's football manager. He's quite young, he's about 34. These allegations, he's been embroiled in controversy because there's been a young black player for England called Ennio Luca, who was very experienced. She got a sort of 100 caps or so. So, you know, a very much an established member of the England women's football team.
A very intelligent woman, a trained lawyer.
Absolutely. Well, and this is it. She's a sports lawyer. Mm. And the FA, I think, thought that she was like everybody else. Do you know what I mean? Mm. I think they've possibly bitten off a bit more than they can chew here. She had made some allegations that Mark Sampson had said racially motivated things to her. Her main complaint seems to be that he had sort of jokingly, I think he was trying to do, when she'd mentioned that she had family coming over from Nigeria, he had said, oh well, hopefully they won't bring us all back Ebola then, or something like that, which is just dreadful. And that she claims that another England player had been asked on her first training camp how many times she had been arrested, and this player was a mixed race player, and Ennio Luca's suggestion was there was a racial dimension to this. Now, you say there were two investigations into this by the FA. Mark Sampson was exonerated by both of them, but the problem here with this, and this is why the FA have had to act now after the most recent lot of allegations, which they've had to sack him for, relate back to when he was manager of the 10 to 16 year old girls side and then the senior team at Bristol. And there are rumours that he had inappropriate relationships with adult players, but that still there were kind of inappropriate sort of aspects to his time there. Now, you say why did the FA acted now? It would seem that that investigation and that report has been sat on someone at the FA's desk since spring 2015, and only now has someone thought to review it in the light of these allegations. The two investigations that the FA have carried out regarding the Ennio Luca allegations are, I think to call them flawed would be somewhat kind, frankly. And actually, I'm going to finish this by actually just, forgive me for reading something out, but I think this is a great summary. Daniel Taylor, they did an extensive interview with Ennio Luca in the middle of August. And so this was published on the 22nd of August. 10 questions the FA must now answer. And I think this completely sums up all of the kind of so the mixed race player who has since been named. So question one. How could the Football Association, with its internal review and Catherine Newton, the barrister who undertook the second investigation on behalf of the FA, conduct their inquiries without speaking to the most relevant player? Now, Ennio Luca wouldn't name her, but she had said that the player was a mixed race midfielder, the only one in the England squad, who had been raised in southeast London. She told them where it had taken place and that it was the player's first training camp. And they've said, apart from adding her telephone number and home address, it's difficult to think what else the FA needed to establish that. A simple search of the internet could have given them the name within minutes. Newton's inquiry lasted 3 months, yet the FA's version of events is that the player's name was unknown. Question two. How could the findings of the FA's internal review be delivered to Luca, basically exonerating Mark Sampson, before the inquiry had spoken to Leanne Sanderson, who is one of the players who'd been named as a key witness and is, yes, you guessed it, mixed race. She and Ennio Luca, by the way, and this other player, none of them have been picked since this has all happened. Question three. How can the FA justify not launching a full investigation after receiving a letter from the Players Football Association stating Ennio Luca had evidence of Mark Sampson telling her to make sure her Nigerian relatives didn't bring Ebola to Wembley? Not sure why that didn't trigger an investigation. For, after 11 years as an England player, Ennio Luca was dropped by Mark Sampson for unlioness behaviour within 2 weeks of participating in the FA's culture review. I mean, the FA and the BBC are as one, it would seem, at times, and raising her grievances in what was she was assured would be a confidential process. Is that just an innocent coincidence? Question five. Ennio Luca says that within 24 hours of attending a meeting with Dan Ashworth and Rachel Brace to discuss her case, she received an email from the FA stating she was under investigation for her work as a sports lawyer. Question six. Why has the FA not issued a public statement since Aluko alleged the Ebola comment? Kick it football out of racism, or racism out of football rather, and the PFA have asked for a new independent inquiry, and two other players went on. Seven. Why was Catherine Newton not asked to investigate the FA's conduct when she was appointed to oversee what had been described by the governing body as an independent inquiry? And then we talk about the alleged video. There was a video recording of a meeting.
Of the midfielders.
Basically saying that there was a video which had on record Sampson saying, "You've been arrested before, haven't you? Four times, isn't it?" Newton didn't watch a video.
It's extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary.
Speaking of that video, why has the FA refused to hand it over to Aluko and her legal team? Question nine. Did Mark Sampson orchestrate a deliberate social media campaign as a response to any Aluko's claim? So two players have told the Guardian about what they saw a deliberate pattern emerging. The PFA's letter to the FA makes the same point, showing the number of tweets showing praise and isolated adulation for Barack Obama, Serena Williams and Nicola Adams, who all have one thing in common compared. And 10, why did the FA offer Ennio Luca an £80,000 settlement, including a confidentiality agreement? And we've had another development in that story today, in that it's now reported in one of the newspapers that the FA are currently withholding some of that money. So actually, yes, he was exonerated by two investigations. They stink, frankly. They stink like hell. They were launched as the first investigation seemed to be, let's get him off. Let's find a way of getting him off. And the second investigation seemed to be I suppose we better look like we're doing this properly. There seems to be inherent flaws in how independent Catherine Newton was. I'm not blaming her, but how independent her role was. The reason why they've had to act on this Bristol allegations is that it is shocking, absolutely shocking, that it's taken a complete foul up of another incident to make them reinvestigate the previous thing. And I really feel for Ennio Luca in a lot of ways, and she made a very telling statement which I actually found quite saddening, really. So Sampson was sacked after England had beaten Russia 6-0, and there was what was obviously a choreographed goal celebration when all of the players ran over to hug him, and they went on about how much they supported him and what a great team they were. Ennio Luca, I thought, rather dignifiedly made the point that those same players had all unanimously nominated her to go into negotiate sort of their contracts and their kind of wage negotiations and things, and they have made her their representative, and they are more than happy for her to do that. And then for them to run over and celebrate someone that had made a racist comment comment towards her, it didn't reflect very well on them, I didn't think, and it left something of a bad taste in my mouth. I found it to be a bit, and it was very interesting how the BBC's tone, Gabby Yoroth and Kelly Smith and the panel on that night, was kind of a bit poor Mark, and I wonder if any of those people will be saying that now, frankly.
Well, this whole process throws up the question that just won't go away, and we agreed on this, you and I, after the Sam Allardyce debacle, and nothing has changed. The Football Association isn't fit for purpose. Still has as its hierarchy men whose first thought is to save face, cover up, hang on to their corporate positions. And all of these grey men, they love the royal box, shaking hands with Prince William, photo opportunities with David Beckham. But they're not fit for the job of running football. And one of the great sadnesses of this is at grassroots level, local level. The Football Association representatives there do a really good job running local leagues, making sure that teams have referees for their games for, you know, under nine league and whatever, and training referees and that. But nationally, corporately, it's a disgrace. And the failures in the bigger picture, which in a way relate to this, why is there, out of 92 clubs in the league, only one non-white manager, Chris Houghton at Brighton, one from 92. Why do we never see non-white referees or assistants at the high levels?
There was Uriah Rennie, wasn't there?
Yeah, but I mean, we're picking one from 20 years ago. Yeah, exactly. There are no women managers in the senior game. Where are the women referees? These are grim indictments for all the slick promos they put on the big screens at Wembley about, oh, you know, we're kicking racism out, and, you know, we're an inclusive organisational thing. For all of that, all the announcements of initiatives, these are dreadful failures. And the top honchos of the FA, it just needs to be dismantled, and the whole structure and personnel need to be changed for this to be fixed in any way.
Absolutely, I really can't be, doing it. I think it's appalling, absolutely appalling. And in a way, I'm glad Sampson's gone, because when I say I'm glad Sampson's gone,
I'd like a proper investigation first before we say that.
Investigation, but having said that, I don't know. It's very telling, I think, that there are two completely different incidents which involve, you know, alleged unacceptable behaviour in different ways. Let's see. But in the meantime, having said that, would the FA have had to have gone to such great lengths to have non-investigations if everyone felt that he had nothing to hide? Why didn't they not just do a proper investigation and then he would have been cleared?
If you were a senior figure at the BBC charged with finding new people to present an art show on BBC Two with a focus on reviewing the theatre...
Well, you'd call us, obviously, because, you know, you're a great expert on all things theatre involving rucksacks therein.
Indeed so. No one could argue that. If you were going to focus on reviewing the theatre, would you select three people to conduct that presentation and review the theatre? Select three people who say they don't like going to the theatre. That's next after De La Soul.
That's a magic number. Three. Yes, it is. It's the magic number. Three. Somewhere in this hip-hop soul community was born three, makes the Vimy, and that's a magic number.
What does it all mean?
Difficult preaching is posthumous pleasure. Pleasure in preaching starts in the heart. Something that stimulates the music in a measure. Measure in the music, race in three parts. Casually see, but don't do like the soul. Cause seeing and doing are actions for monkeys. Doing hip hop, hustle, no rock and roll. Unless your name's Brewster, cause Brewster's a punk. Three. Parents let go, cause it's magic in the air. Criticizing rap shows you're out of order. Stop looking, listen to the phrase and Fred Astaire's. And don't get offended while Mace Do-Si-Do's your daughter. A tri-camera roll system is now set. Fly around the store under Daisy Productions. It stands for the inner sound. Y'all in your Quebec, that the action's not a trick, but show not a function. Everybody wants to be a DJ, everybody wants to be an MC, but being speakers are the best, and you don't have to guess. De La Soul Posse consists of three, and that's the magic number.
Three.
This here piece of the pie is not dessert, but the cost that we dine, and three out of every darn time, the effect is, where the daisy grows in your mind. Showing true position, this here piece is kissing the part of the pie that's missing, where that negative number fills up the casualty. Maybe you can subtract it, you can call it your lucky partner, maybe you can call it your adjective. But odd as it may be, without my one and two, where would there be my three mates, possibly me, and that's the magic number.
What does it all mean?
Focus is formed by flaunt of the soul. Souls who flaunt style gain praises by pounds. Common on speakers who honor the scroll. Scroll written daily creates a new sound. Listeners listen, cause this here is wisdom. Wisdom of a speaker, a dumb and a plug. Set aside a legal substance and feed them for now. Get them high off this dialect drug.
Three.
Time is a factor, so it's time to count. Count not the negative actions of one. Speakers of soul say it's time to shout. Three forms the soul to a positive sum. Dance to this fix and flex every muscle. Space can be filled if you ride like my lumber. Advance to the tune, but don't do the hustle, shake, rattle, roll to my magic number.
Now you may try to subtract it, but it just won't go away. 3 times 1.
What is it?
1, 2, 3.
That's a magic number.
Yo, what's up?
1, 2, 3.
Okay, children. What does it all mean?
Whoa.
1, 2, 3.
I would like
no more, no less.
That's a magic number.
No more, no less.
What is it?
No more, no less.
Is this
no
the future?
Unbelievably now, nearly 20 years old.
I will not believe you. I'm sorry. I can't accept that.
1988, that was recorded. Forever linked in my own memory with driving through the Midwestern America in more innocent days. De La Soul from the album 3 Feet High and Rising. And it's still, to me, sounds like nothing else we've ever heard. It's so innovative. Commercially, they were always more successful over here than in America. It wasn't a hit in America, but it made number 7 over here as a single. De La Soul and the Magic Number.
Yeah.
Now, Front Row, a consistently well-regarded arts-related programme on BBC Radio 4, presented by Samira Ahmed, Kirsty Lang and John Wilson, each of whom...
And occasionally Mark Lawson as well, or has he stopped now?
He had to leave under rather difficult...
Yes, I remember now. And it has indeed robbed me of my favourite piece of enjoyment of Front Row, which was, I don't know if people have seen, there's a comedian called Jakey Yap, who I find quite funny, and he did Radio 4 in 4 minutes once on YouTube. It's worth watching, by the way. It's brilliant. If you're a fan of Radio 4, is affectionate and scathing at the same time, and his Front Row kind of review, it sort of impression was, hello, tripping over the first sentence as if it were a plaything slab. I'm Mark Lawson on Front Row, and every time I think of Front Row now, I think of someone tripping over the first sentence as if it were a paving slab.
Yes, if you're at the BBC, you're not allowed to mention Mark Lawson or Front Row in the same sentence.
Indeed, but we're not, so I have.
We're not, so that's all fine. That last minute or so never happened.
Absolutely.
Samira Ahmed, Kirsty Lang, John Wilson, they each give the impression that they not only like the arts, but willingly attend events around music, film and theatre.
It's a pretty cool thing to be paid to do for a living, isn't it?
It really is. Now the BBC has announced that there is to be a television version of Front Row, and we mere viewers might assume that the same criteria of enthusiasm might be shown by the presenters chosen to for this task. However, in interviews related to the launch, the new presenters seem rather less taken with the theatre than we might hope. Nikki Beddy says that she resents theatre as there is no interval. She said in an interview with the Radio Times, even though I don't think I've ever been to any theatre where there isn't an interval. I thought perhaps she's getting confused with movies there. Amol Rajan says he's been too busy with his young family to actually go to the theatre. And Giles Corran says he finds plays too stressful and he's barely been to the theatre in the last 6 or 7 years. So welcome to your bright new arts presenting trio, Jules.
Yeah, I know. It's. I mean, to be honest, I think the bit I drew comparisons with the BBC and the FA early on, which is they always find a way of getting the right decision wrong, no matter what they do. They always seem to find a way of messing it up. I mean, I have to say, I did have a slight snigger. I mean, you know, for all that the BBC tries to send itself up with W1A and all that sort of thing, I did have a quick snigger. My dad always said, you know, what is the real story that we are looking at here, and looking and see the BBC director of the arts is quoted as being called Jaunty Claypole. I'm just going to put that there. I'm just leaving that there. So the Radio 4 version, it has a TV spin-off. Now, like I said, the BBC can't do right for being wrong. This is off the back of the fact that the BBC and BBC Radio 4 announced they were going to axe Saturday Review, and then there was such a hoo-ha about it that they've now reinstated it. So the BBC tries to put itself as being, you know, the patron of the arts and all that kind of stuff. And I'm not entirely convinced that the BBC's decision-making process always bears that out, to be honest. So, yeah, again, just putting that out there. As far as their choices of these three people are concerned... Anoush Shakodian wrote an attempted defence of the in defence of BBC front row presenters who don't like theatre in the New Statesman. She said that she, when you first look at the presenters, you think why they've been chosen anyway. The BBC's media editor Amol Jahn and restaurant grouch, as he is described here, Giles Corran. I mean, Nikki Beddy makes a bit more sense in that she is the arts hour and loose ends journalist. So I say, yeah, fair enough. That's horses for courses there, I think. I find it frustrating, and this is the angle I'm going to take on it. I find it annoying when, particularly in the case of Giles Corran, I'm sorry for singling him out, but I am going to single him out here.
Fair enough.
You know, regular listeners know how brilliant I think Victoria Corran Mitchell is. I think she's fab. I think she's extremely talented, extremely witty. You know, I enjoy her columns in The Observer more often than not. I think she's great. I don't necessarily think that she would have needed her surname to get to where she is. I think it's been useful for her, but I think that she might have forged a way otherwise because I think she has significant talent. I can't put my hand on my heart and say the same thing about her brother, I'm afraid. I think he did get where he is because of his surname. Apologies if he's listening or anyone else is listening for me to tell me that I'm wrong, but that is my view having consumed a lot of his media hashtag content. And I therefore find it frustrating that people like that, I won't necessarily single him out, but people like that who perhaps might have got into broadcasting for reasons other than talent or might have been helped along their way, basically end up getting any old job, don't they? They get rewarded with a job on Front Row on BBC TV, a successful format on the radio, nice new programme on the TV, quite a prestige gig, I should think. There are thousands and thousands of young journalists in this country who would give their right arm and probably their left as well to get that gig, who do love going to the theatre, who or at least are willing to consider the idea that reviewing theatre, I mean, it's not even like, I mean, I do feel a bit sorry for the Furore in that it's not the only thing that Front Row covers. Front Row is excellent in that it covers TV and music and it covers the whole kind of spectrum. They don't, and the art shows, they don't just cover theatre, but it is a, you know, obviously a key plank in their platform, to use a phrase my dreadful old boss used to say. So I do find it slightly offensive that if you're going on that programme, you're wanting to call yourself an arts journalist, aren't you? I think, you know, that if you're going on the Front Row of your TV show and talking about art, that to me means you're holding yourself out as being an authority to do that, or at least having some kind of, even if you're not quote-unquote qualified, have some interest and in it. It qualifies you as far as I'm concerned, and I do find it offensive. It's always the same old names that get dumped into things to, you know, to present things, when in fact, you know, if they can't even be bothered to show any interest in it, then if you're not interested, fine. Why don't you step aside and give your salary check back so that a young person that's really interested in it, who could probably do as good, if not a better job than you in some cases, can just step in and have a go?
I'm sure all three presenters have their merits, but we're into the same old situation of the Claire Balding syndrome, where we ask, you know, isn't there anybody new who can present TV shows? Why is it always the same people, as you say? And again, to endorse what you say, surely there must be some enthusiastic, energetic young presenters who have the time and indeed vitally the zest to actually want to go and see plays and musicals and whatever. And on the point you make about you know, the same old people, so I've got a friend on Twitter called Gagarin, I think his real name is Steve, I'm not too sure, but he's very, very good with sort of pithy, witty one-liners.
Yes, I think I follow him as well.
He's very, very good. And he said when this story came out, you know, is it only people who attend the Corran Mitchell Boxing Day party each year who get these jobs. And I think there is something to that. Mm. Of course, Giles Corran has made it his thing to be grumpy at everything.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
He has subsequently said
that... I find that to be tedious anyway, to be honest.
It's a bit laborious after sort of 20 years of it, yes. He said that he was joking with some of his comments, but joking or not. Now, I'm just going to head in another direction here, because I do have some agreement with Giles Corran when he says that going in this piece that we're talking about, interview with the Radio Times, quoted elsewhere in the Telegraph and wherever... I do have some sympathy, which says that going to the theatre in London can be a really negative experience. It's ludicrously expensive, often poor sight lines, and worst of all, and again I encountered this at the Playhouse Theatre last Saturday, cramped, uncomfortable seating. And we were in the, you know, in the posh seats in the stalls. Many, if not most, of London's theatres were built in the Victorian era for an entirely different purpose. They was like music halls and variety,
yeah, sure.
And they're not fit for the modern theatre goer. And despite all the palaver about their listed status and all that business, most of them need, at the very least, all the seats stripped out and to be redesigned. It's the discomfort that puts me off more than anything else. So I'm with Giles Corran on that.
Yes, yeah, true, and I think, and I don't, you know, they do raise some, I think, good points on how, you know, theatre going is not always very accessible or the practicalities are not very, very enjoyable. But I think more effort could have been made to distinguish that from the idea that, you know, that you take no interest in it at all.
Oh, no, absolutely. But, you know, just to round that point off, when you're now to go and see the Book of Mormon in London's West End, you know, you're pretty much paying over £200 for a seat.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
We're getting into sort of ludicrous. Of course, with the reliance on tourism for much of the trade, people will pay that. If you've come to London from America or Japan... Or you know, China or Russia, and you've got the money, you'll pay those. And this is reflected quite often when you're in the bar in the interval, or you're coming out of London theatres now. I mean, in a way, it's wonderful. You hear a whole range of languages and, you know, accents and so on. But I do believe that young people who want to go and see the theatre from this country simply can't afford to do so.
No, absolutely. And that's something which needs to be taken on. And I wonder if perhaps young unknown journalists getting exposure on TV, they might and we've moaned previously about we've moaned previously, you don't even need to finish that sentence, but specifically we have moaned previously about pundits on Match of the Day in the past having been in not wanted to criticize anyone because they don't want to alienate anybody for charity.
They're golfing buddies,
charity golf days. I wonder if actually, this is a slight side point. If you had unknown people on front row, I wonder if it would be more interesting. Because you haven't got anybody that needs to worry about bumping to anybody in the Groucho Club. You've got someone that can just go for it and can actually say, look, you know, as a young person that wants to go to the theatre, I haven't got £200 to pay on the Book of Mormon, nor have I got 3 hours to queue up for £10 returns on a Monday morning when I'm meant to be in work. So actually, I wonder if that would be better coming from somebody who isn't a member of Soho House.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the Yentob syndrome.
For that reason alone, dump everybody that we've known ever and put new people on stuff.
Are you appearing at any venues, comfortable or otherwise, this week, Julie?
I will be relaxing in Soho House without Yentob, obviously. No, I don't think I am this week, actually. I will be pulling over to Brighton for a little bit to go to a few fringe things at the Labour Party conference, I think. If I do have any interesting tales, I'll bring them back with me next week. I very much enjoyed the expression, there's a lot of, will you be in the secure zone? Because you have to have a pass to get to things. So I will not be in the secure zone. I was talking to a fellow Labour Party traveller the other day about how it made it sound like Beirut, and my friend rather wryly commenting that this year's Labour Party conference might be considerably less safe than that, possibly. I'm not sure. But anyway, I will be doing Saturday Social this evening, so I'm very much
lovely.
I'll be live, so it'll be 6 to 7 p.m.
Great show.
Motown, etc. Thank you very much. And I'll be back with Indie Wonderland. I'll return to the saddle this week, so I'll be back next week as well. 8 until 10 p.m. BarrowCaveRadio.com. You can listen on TuneIn as well. There are multiple ways to listen. And I will be doing that. And speaking of multiple ways to listen, You found our podcast. If you're hearing this, you found our podcast. Thank you very much for that. If you would like to, if you want a different way to listen, or you'd like to tell your family and friends to listen, and let's face it, you would, because we're great. You can go on to iTunes and you can subscribe on iTunes, so you needn't miss a single second of Terence's flu and me baptizing children. Why would you want to? And if you wrote a review, then other people could find us, and that'd be super great. So obviously we'd like you to write a nice one. If you don't want to write a nice one, then by all means don't do that. But yeah, that's something you can do. Apparently we're never good at telling people how to come across us, so you can come across us on iTunes or via the Rocking, there's still links on the Rocking Vicar website, or indeed on Podbean.
Yes, thanks.
And you can find us on the Twitter as well, can't you?
You can. At Sir Terence and at SuperJules84.
Indeed, you get kind of, you know, my disastrous art soirees in real time. So if you want to do that, then do.
Huge thanks to executive producer Rona. I was just thinking, we must either get her on quickly in the next week or two, or if she doesn't want to do that, she should give us details. She's been very much involved in an excellent project for raising funds for survivors of the Grenfell Tower fire the actress Kathy Burke, and she's been working with Kathy very closely on this. It's a book called 24 Stories, and I believe it's been launched this week, so I think the best thing actually probably is just to get Rona on for a couple of minutes just to tell us about that.
Let's try and do that. I would love to hear more about that, because it's a project I very much want to support.
Yeah,
so
me too, and she's done some absolutely splendid work on that. Now, an absolute belter of a closing track, Jules.
Well, and I'm glad you think so. Who knows, this might even feature on the Saturday Social this evening. Lovely. I was talking to my mum about something the other day, and she said, oh yes, I saw him when I was walking in the street, and then my brain immediately went to If You See Me Walking Down the Street, and then of course I sang this. I just think it's a wonderful song. I often get it confused with It's Too Late by Carole King in my head, because they have a similar kind of rotating sort of piano riff, but I just think it's magnificent, and you can't go wrong with a bit of Burke Bacharach and Hal David, can you really? It's just absolute genius. This is well, in America she's Dionne Warwick, but to my sort of pidgin English she is Dionne Warwick. And this is Walk On By.
If you see me walking down the street and I start to cry each time we meet, walk on by. Just let me grieve in private, 'cause each time I see you, I break down and cry. Walk on by.
Stop.
Walk on by.
Stop.
Walk on by. Broken and blue, walk on by.
You have been listening to a DACM Media production.